Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. It's Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer. If you haven't listened to Shameless Popery, that's Joe's podcast, you really do yourself a favor and check out some of... He's got, you know, a large body of work there, and then new episodes each week coming out. You just go to shamelessjoe.com. You can look for Joe Heschmeyer or Shameless Popery on YouTube. And you can get it wherever you get your podcasts. You can sign up and listen anytime. They're available to anyone all around the world. Shameless Popery, because Joe is a shameless papist. But are you a papist right now? Like in the interregnum, are you still a papist?
I had a live stream earlier this week, and I just called it Shameless Sedevacantism.
Did you really? Because the Sede, just in case people don't know what Sede means.
Sede and is vacant. Seat, meaning like the chair of Peter, which is a symbol of the papacy. Vacante is just vacant, so the seat is vacant. The chair is empty until a new pope. It is an interregnum is the other term you'll hear for it.
Yeah.
And so we pray for the successor of Pope Francis and, of course, the successor of Peter. Actually, the I'm glad that we didn't even plan this, but the College of Cardinals put out a statement encouraging people to pray, encouraging the faithful, to saying this is the true force that in the church promotes the unity of all the members of the one body of Christ. And faced with the enormity of the task ahead and the urgency of the present time, it is first of all necessary to make ourselves humble instruments of the infinite wisdom and providence of our Heavenly Father in docility to the action of the Holy Spirit. Indeed, He is the protagonist of the life of the people of God, the one to whom we must listen, accepting what He is saying to the church. And then they say, may the Blessed Virgin Mary accompany these prayers with her maternal intercession.
Oh, beautiful. So, beautiful.
Yeah. It's a good reminder that we don't just want to sit idly back and predict or guess or
opine. We do want to do those things in addition.
we totally want to do those things. Share spurious AI-generated images of various people as Pope.
I have seen so many people as Pope in recent days.
Yeah. I may have made a Jimmy Akin as Pope one myself.
Did you? I didn't see
this
it.
This very afternoon. So I sent it to our in-house group chat just because I suggested this would unify East and West with his magnificent beard.
If Jimmy became Pope, which it could happen, he is a baptized, Catholic male. But then the aliens would come. They'd be like, that's one of ours. It's time to come down to Earth.
Perfect.
888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. I wonder if he would use the power of the papacy to get to the bottom of this Bigfoot thing and just settle it once and for all.
I'm not entirely sure that's quite how the power of the papacy works. But
oh, it's an awesome power. Awesome power. The power of the papacy. All kinds of things. So you know, it's funny, too, to kind of look at those cardinals and go, gosh, one of those guys is about to be the Pope. I don't know which one it is, but one of those guys. They could pick someone outside the College of Cardinals.
Right.
But
it's been many centuries since the last time that happened.
Yeah.
Either the 13th or 14th century, I believe, was the last time was a non-cardinal.
Okay, so for the purpose of discussion, Joe.
14th century, 1378.
Let's say there's some abbot somewhere. Right, and they all go, you know, Abbott, whatever, he should be the Pope. Do they have to call him from, like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, how do they do this? They got to call him and go, do you want to be Pope? Or
I actually know how this works.
This is something the church has set up. Yes.
They will send a delegate who is forbidden to speak to anyone else, or anyone else he does, like, if there's someone else he has to speak with, they also have to be kind of sworn to secrecy.
Okay.
Because he can't reveal, like, the mission that he's on, but he might have to do things like, you know, book a flight. So that wouldn't count for it.
Right.
And then he goes and he brings them and then reveals the reason. So I think along the way, you just know you're being brought into a papal conclave. Now you can probably guess what that would entail.
Really? They just go, oh, the cardinals would like to speak with you. Like they don't go, they want you to be Pope. They just say, could you come to the conclave with me?
Right. And it's fascinating.
I'd guess it. I would guess it. I'm very smart. I would guess it.
I mean, you probably already have guessed what they're going to ask you. So I'm not sure if smart is, it might just be a view of self.
As
like,
much
I'll fix it.
As much as they would want to, and I know they would. I mean, many of them would. I feel like a married man is very unlikely to get the call to be the Pope.
I think so, too.
So they have
it
to.
It would be a real burden.
So here's the Cardinals, right? If they decide they want someone outside the conclave, they like open the front door and they go, send somebody in here. And somebody comes in and goes, get on a plane and go to wherever this abbot is. And then they go to the abbot and that come with me. They'd like to see you in the conclave. I can't tell you what it's about. At this point, you know you would wink. You couldn't stop yourself. You'd be like, I can't tell you what it's about.
And then imagine your disappointment if it turned out they were just like, we can't get the Wi-Fi working.
Yeah, right. Like, do you have the password? Someone said Pope Francis gave it to you.
Just to be clear, there's no Wi-Fi in the conclave, but you get the idea.
Yeah. But, okay, but then the guy, okay, so he doesn't want to be Pope. He goes all the way to Rome, and he goes, no, I'm not your man. You're going to have to ask somebody else.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And, I mean, that is, as strange as that is about the most realistic way that you would trigger the provision in paragraph 87 of Universi Dominici Gregis. So it talks about how, like, the last step of getting a new pope is, do you accept your canonical election as supreme pontiff? And the guy can say no, in which case you just go back to the drawing board and keep voting.
Right. Well, Pope Francis said he considered saying no. He actually, he said, give me a minute. And he went off by himself and prayed, he said. Which I think actually that's kind of prudent. Like, that's not something you want to just go, oh, of course, sure, no problem. Can I have weekends off?
Actually, I already had plans next week.
Yeah, right. This is fascinating to me, Joe, that there is a provision for this. So that's interesting. I can't think of anybody who it could be. Like, there's not some...
No, I think you've probably got it right in the sense that sometimes there will be like a particularly holy like abbot or, you know, someone involved in a religious order. But when I say sometimes, I think Celestine V is the last time that happened. And he
didn't really like
lasted. He lasted 5 months. So, it turns out when you ask a hermit to lead the church, they might be like, this is a lot of people. This is not what I had originally set out to serve God.
Well, they had the right idea. They wanted a holy man, but he was holy in part because he had devoted himself to a life of solitary prayer. And then you get to Rome, and there's a lot of rich foods here. This is not matching.
And just the busyness of it. It's just not the lifestyle one has kind of set their heart on and their entire life around in terms of the whole plan of life, having silence and prayer and structure and all of that. A lot of the sheer number of visitors you're entertaining and number of people you're interacting with and everything else, it had to have been just overwhelming. And, you know, I mean, I don't mean that you can't be a very holy pope. It's just a very different call to holiness.
Oh, sure, yeah. You can be a holy king.
You know, Francis
but...
de Sales talks about this in terms of just the difference between, like, someone called to a life of, you know, silent contemplation and a bishop and a parent and everything else. These are different calls, all ordered to sainthood, but different kinds of saints. So yeah, the other kind of the twist with Celestine V is he was elected pope after the longest period of time in which there had been
no pope.
Like a papal interregnum.
Yeah.
It was like 2 years long. And so then they're like, okay, finally. And then 5 months later, he's like, actually, I resign. I have to imagine that was a little dispiriting.
They weren't
very
nice to popes who resigned in those days either. It wasn't like Pope Benedict resigning.
That's true.
Where they treated him well.
Right, because he was a potential kind of threat to the pope. So I think he was very, like Boniface VIII, who succeeded him, was very worried about him.
Yeah. All right, let's just take a break then. I didn't even know we were going to talk about that, but I'm fascinated by that thought.
Yeah. But it could hopefully, you know, people are also. Otherwise, they're going to be like, why
did you just talk about
Celestine the Fifth for that long?
But that is the most interesting conversation about the papacy that I've heard on any media. Everybody's talking about the same things. Who's it going to be? We talk about what if it's a monk?
Yeah. What if it's a random abbot? What would happen?
Yeah. What would happen then? That's why you got to keep listening. We'll be right back with more of it. Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you looking to study Catholic theology in a formal way with the guidance of faithful scholars? Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by the Augustine Institute, offering master's degrees in theology, pastoral theology, and Catholic education with flexible study options on campus, online, or both. The Augustine Institute equips students to serve Christ and His church in schools, parishes, dioceses, apostolates, and the home. Learn more today at augustine.edu.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, Saturday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and you are welcome to call with whatever question you got. And I'm going to go to the phones just because I neglected to do it for the whole first segment because I got carried away with an exciting conversation with Joe. Salvatore is in Las Vegas, Nevada, listening on our website, Catholic.com. Salvatore, welcome.
Thank you. So my question is regards of canon, because I'm aware of the whole arguments with Protestantism, but I've yet to heard one about Orthodoxy, and I'm aware that they include Maccabees 3, 4, and some Orthodox even include other scriptures like the Book of Enoch or the Gospel of Thomas. So is that a good argument against Orthodoxy, that they don't have some defined canon of scripture, and how would they typically argue against that?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think it is a good argument if you do the right caveats and kind of frame it in the right way. So here's what I would say to that. So, you know, because I could imagine someone replying, well, the early Christians didn't have a set biblical canon. And so therefore, how can you insist this is necessary? And, you know, if the lack of a biblical canon didn't invalidate the early church, then it doesn't invalidate Orthodoxy. That would be what I would anticipate as the rebuttal. But I think you can say this, that it isn't just that there isn't an agreed upon Bible in Eastern Orthodoxy, is that there doesn't appear to be a mechanism to produce an agreed upon Bible. Like, it's okay if a particular question hasn't been resolved yet, but it's a very different thing to say it's unresolvable and that you don't even know by what mechanism a resolution could happen. And then I would want to put the problem of, well, you don't have an agreed upon Bible in relation to several other problems, like the general failure to have any Orthodox-wide dogmatic definitions of anything after the split from Rome, that it appears that in the first millennium, the church, East and West, was quite happy to define doctrine, quite happy to get into even the theological weeds of the three persons in one essence and God, or the two natures of Christ, et cetera, et cetera. And then after 1054, the East appears to be incapable of doing that anymore, incapable of resolving that. And sometimes we'll try to spin that as a positive and say, oh, you know, these Western Christians are all obsessed with defining everything instead of leaving it as a mystery. And it's like, no, you guys defined things too when you were in full union with the church, because dogmatic definitions are really important. So I would then tie it to a point that Bishop Callistus Ware God rest his soul, made, which is that the Orthodox don't have an agreement on how many ecumenical councils there are or what it is to be an ecumenical council. And he points out that many say seven, but others will say eight or nine, that there are at least three other councils that are held by some Orthodox and not others. And so that's a real problem. Like, we can say as a matter of history that the reason that the so-called robber council, Second Ephesus, wasn't accepted in East or West is because the Pope rejected it. And rightly so, because it was heretical. But if you don't have the Pope to say which are and aren't the valid councils, then I don't know how you get to which councils can settle things, and therefore I don't know how you would get to even how you could potentially come up with an agreed-upon biblical list. So that would be kind of how I would frame it. In other words, to make sure it's not just you don't have one yet, therefore you're missing something, but you don't have one and don't appear to have a way of getting one.
Does that...
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
Yeah.
You know what? If you want to stick around, Michael Lofton's book, Answering Orthodoxy, is that the name of it?
Yeah, Answering Orthodoxy. We'll be happy to send it to him. Would you like Salvatore? You don't have to say on the air if you would like it. We'll send it to you if you give us an address. Just hang on. Answering Orthodoxy, Michael Lofton, and it just answers a whole bunch of questions related to the Catholic Orthodox debates and questions and relationship and all that. So, hang on. We'd love to send it to you. It's a very good book. Anyone can get it at shop.catholic.com. It's on sale right now. Answering Orthodoxy. All right, let's go to Joel in Mansfield, Ohio, listening on Annunciation Radio. Glad to have you here, Joel. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. I converted a few years ago, and my brother did not convert. So every once in a while, he sends me a zinger. And just Tuesday, he said to me that the Catholic Church had a female pope named Pope Joan. And he said that there was a board game about it. So I looked it up online. I'd never heard of that. And I just wondered if that was true or just an urban myth.
It is absolutely an urban myth. And I don't think any historian thinks otherwise because, well, for a number of reasons. One, the different people claiming there was a Pope Joan can't agree what century she existed in or any of the kind of basic details. It's clearly a salacious kind of story that the medievals came up with and came up with hundreds of years after the alleged event happened. But we can say with a pretty good deal of precision, like who each pope was. So there's no big gaps where you could have had a Pope Joan in there. And it would be quite remarkable given the centrality of the papacy during this period that no one would notice. Oh yeah. Remember that time we accidentally elected a woman as Pope? So it's a total myth. I will confess that it was a myth I believed when I was in college and was quite embarrassed when I asked a Catholic about it and he explained like, oh yeah, that's definitely not a real thing. So in honor of Pope Urban, I think Cy wants to call it an urban legend.
I would be delighted to call it an urban legend. Thank you very much for including me in your tomfoolery. But your brother likes to call you with zingers because when you say zinger, these are things that are supposed to discredit the Catholic claims. Is that the idea?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
we collect them up. We'll make a book responding to Joel's brother's zingers. I think that we'd sell a million copies of it.
I think we'll just call it the Big Book of Catholic Answers. I think we have that book.
Oh, Joel.
I do want to give a shout out for Joe's book, The Early Church is a Catholic Church. I have that. I got that not too long ago, and I read it cover to cover. It has a lot of good research in it.
Very good.
I'm grateful to hear that. I want to say, if you keep doing this where you're reading actual books with footnotes and history and citations and your brother's just parroting medieval internet rumors, he's kind of bringing a knife to a gunfight. You should point that out to him. He's got to up his game and read books.
There was no medieval internet. That is
As I said, medieval internet rumor, I really liked the phrase, yeah. So I didn't correct it. I was like, oh, yeah, I like the idea that we're on the medieval internet.
Joel, hang out. We want to supersize your abilities to contest with your brother's zingers. And so we are going to send you a copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers if you would like it. All you have to do is stay right there. And Edgar, whenever he feels like it, that's how we do it. Edgar just picks up the line whenever he feels like it. And then he will get an address from you and we will send the book out to you. Off we go to Texas. Christian is in Texas watching on YouTube. Welcome, Christian. You got a question for Joe?
Hi. Yes, I'm a big fan of the show. Yesterday... a Protestant YouTuber and apologist, Redeemed Zoomer, uploaded a video and addressed certain things about the Catholic Church, including alleged contradictions in the ecumenical councils. How can I, as a Catholic, defend the councils? And, I guess that's my question.
Okay. So I actually started to watch that video last night, and then I don't even remember. I got distracted. So I didn't actually get to the part where he laid that out. So could you fill me in? What were the alleged contradictions?
Well, he wasn't really directly quoting the councils. He did reference the Council of Florence, and the main thing that he brought up was the Catholic Church anathematizing certain sects and then supposedly renouncing those anathemas pertaining to Vatican II and everything.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It wasn't directly quotations. Sorry.
So, yeah, the basic argument here is the Council of Florence talks about the necessity of being Catholic for salvation. And this is,
right,
by the way, longstanding Christian teaching. I was just reading earlier today St. Jerome talking about union with the Church of Rome being akin to being on Noah's Ark, outside of which you're not going to live. And this is in the 300s, 376, I believe. So this isn't right. Some medieval invention. Clearly, when the Council of Florence is talking about this, it is reiterating longstanding Christian teaching. And that is unpopular for obvious reasons for Protestants who are not in full communion with the Church of Rome. But it's worth just telling the truth about this. It is not enough to just have Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior, because Christ comes to build a church, and we can't accept the head and reject the body without putting ourselves in spiritual danger. Now,
amen.
We need to also put a very heavy caveat on everything I just said, and the Second Vatican Council does that, which is when we're talking about these things, and we talk about if you do X, you'll go to hell, we mean someone who does X knowingly and willingly. So to take an example that might be upsetting to some people, sex outside of marriage is mortally sinful. But someone who is a victim of rape is not guilty of that. Someone who thinks they're in a marriage, but unbeknownst to them, their marriage is actually not, maybe their spouse was actually previously married. They didn't realize it, et cetera. They're not guilty of any sin. That doesn't mean sex outside of marriage isn't wrong, but it means that when we talk about fornication, adultery, etc., we mean someone who is knowingly and intentionally doing those things. Well, likewise with schism, there's a difference between someone knowingly breaking off communion in the church and someone who was raised for, generations. Their family has been outside of full communion with the church, and so they've been part of the only ecclesial body they've ever known. So those are two very different cases, two very different situations. And so the world of the Council of Florence looks very different than the world of the Second Vatican Council. And so the two councils address the world and the situation of Christians and those in estranged relationships in different ways because the situation has changed, not because the truth has changed. Does that make sense?
Because that's
a common error people fall into. The medieval world, the assumption was you knew the Catholic claim and accepted it or rejected it. And we no longer make that assumption. You got people out there thinking Pope Joan was a real person.
Ooh, that was a callback to the call right before you there, right, Christian.
right. His brother, not him. He was being humble enough to double check.
Right. Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so. Joel, I feel your pain. My brother comes with me with zingers all the time. So
we need to do a book of brother zingers.
We need more caller interaction.
Yeah, we should do that. Like call and with your brother or sister who gives you zingers against the Catholic Church, and that would be a fun show. Darren, did you write that down? He totally pretended to write it down. He doesn't even have anything to write it down with. All right, Christian, thanks. Let's go to Ella in Florida watching on YouTube. Ella, go ahead with your question. No, Ella?
That's December.
No, the first Noella. That was our first Noella today. There, nice. I joined in. I joined in with your tomfoolery on that one.
Yeah.
All right, I'll come back to you, Ella. If you're there, it might be
ironically making it not the first Noella, but yeah.
Oh, my Noella was the second Noella. Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I apologize that there is no song the second Noella. All right. Well, that doesn't leave me with enough time to go back to the phones. Is anybody checking on Ella on line six? I think she's probably there, and maybe there's a. Maybe the mute button got pushed or something. But I could also be projecting that because about 30% of my calls involve me going, can you hear me? And then realizing that I pushed the mute button. I would say at least 30% of my calls involve that. And there have been numerous meetings here at Catholic Answers where I thought I was participating and no one was listening to me. And then realized I'm not actually participating in the meeting because there's a little line through my microphone graphic.
I'm really grateful that's the reason why. No one was listening to you.
Otherwise, Joe, I am a respected figure around here that people listen to.
Yes, exactly. I would have been horrified if we were just ignoring your sage advice.
Uh-huh. Right back with more Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin Podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
On Thursday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, our topic will be, whom or what are you praying for? And now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest this hour. Shameless Popery. Check out Shameless Popery. You going out to speak anywhere, Joe? You got any public speaking you want to mention?
This weekend, there's a special gathering of people who contribute to Catholic Answers in glorious downtown Kansas City. It'll be a nice 20-minute drive. I'm very much looking forward to spending time with everybody.
That's right. You're going to a major conference, and it's 20 minutes from your house.
It's great. You can't beat that.
That's really nice.
Get to eat nice food and then go at home and sleep in my own bed at the end of the day. So.
Wow. Your bed and nice food are two of your favorite things, too. You talk about them all the time.
And I love that people have Catholic answers, so it's going to be like the trifecta.
All right. Let's go back to Florida. Adrian is in Florida watching on YouTube. Adrian, sorry to keep you waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hello.
Hi.
My question was, in what way does Christ fulfill Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4, the world peace prophecy? Because often I hear Jews, that's one of their main objections, is that Christ did not restore world peace or create world peace.
Okay, yeah. So the beating of swords into plowshares and all of this is obviously metaphorical language. Hopefully that is clear. You know, obviously you have a bigger problem of like how many people are using plowshares today, or for that matter, swords. So, you know, obviously there is some metaphorical language being used, but it is talking about the creation of peace. And I think we can miss this in a couple of ways. Number one, we don't realize how barbaric the world was before Christianity. I was reading recently Bart Ehrman in his upcoming book talks about like just the rise of mercy and all of this. When you compare pre and post Christian society, there is this radical sea change. And so as a result, like they're really, I haven't read the upcoming book, obviously, I don't think it's out yet, but there's something radical about the Christian message that really does transform the world. And because we're on the other end of it, and because we're in a world that in many ways has grown cold to the gospel and is now moving in this very dark anti-Christian direction, we miss how violent the world was before Christianity and how violent the world is in those areas that have rejected Christianity. I would say look at the death toll in places run by atheistic regimes, and you'll see the difference Christianity makes. That'd be like the first thing. Second, the ultimate meaning of these passages about Christ coming to bring peace. Now, he's clear that he does in one way. Peace I give you, my peace I leave with you. But then he also says, I come not to bring peace, but the sword. How are both these things true? Well, you have to understand what it means to have peace. Peace is not simply the absence of conflict. Peace is right ordering. And so you can have, you know, a society of extreme oppression, but because the people are afraid to rise up, there's no violence. But they're not really at peace. Their institutionalized oppression isn't the same as peace. Peace is in right ordering, right relationships. And so what Christ comes to bring us is a radical kind of peace that the world cannot bring, because it's rightly ordered relationship with God and my neighbor in a way that was impossible before. And so, you know, once again, we can easily take these things for granted. But just to give, you know, maybe one fact I like to think about from time to time. St. Thomas Aquinas is from Italy. He studies at the University of Paris in France, and his teacher is St. Albert the Great from Germany. These were countries that, but for Christianity, would have been in much more violent conflict with one another than they even were. But as a result of a common faith, they're able to come together and produce works of intellectual brilliance and theological ingenuity in a way that would have been unthinkable in say, the pagan world. Do you see what I mean? So there is something radical that across national and even imperial lines, you have people drawn together by a shared citizenship in the kingdom of God in a way that creates a new type of peace that would have been unthinkable in the past.
Okay. That's an excellent answer. Yes, that helps me.
Very good.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the call. Just a little north of Florida, we go to Georgia. Chris is in Georgia listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Chris, thanks for downloading our app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi. First off, I'd just like to say that, Si, I was sorry to hear about your mother.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
I want you to know that I'm praying for you and your family, and I encourage other listeners to do as well.
That's very kind of you, Chris. Thank you for saying
that. I'm very glad you said that. I told myself I was going to say that before and then completely forgot to invite people to pray for Joanne.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Great. Yeah, also, to shout out Joe Heschmeyer, Shameless Popery, Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Thank you.
Is there some way we can hire you, Chris? Are you available? Or?
No, I see you guys just got a new hire, Emily Torres, though.
You stay up on your... Yeah. Yeah, she joins us in July, right? We'll get Emily here in July. Yeah. All right, Chris, go ahead with the question.
Yeah, I'll get to it. So my question was, after the resurrection, what was the fallout in sort of the Jewish community? I guess more specifically among the Sadducees. They just had this man crucified, and it seems like that's not something that they would have just let go. And they certainly were
yes.
probably too ignorant to, or I guess not ignorant. What's another word for stubborn? I don't know, but to.
I think stubborn is a good one. Wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, it just seems like I don't know that much about it, and I haven't really heard that much about it. I don't know if there's any writings about it, but it just seems like, you know, Jesus was walking the earth for 40-ish days after the resurrection. Like, they had plenty of time to respond if they were going to do something. So, yeah, what did people like Caiaphas and other Jews, non-believing Jews, think at the time?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, one thing that we should say is, first of all, there appear to have been a number of conversions to Christianity. So I think one response people had to the resurrection was they became Christian in droves. Another response was to reject it, of course, to think that the apostles were making this up, to think that the apostles stole Jesus's body. And as you say, in the case of the Sadducees, they have some philosophical objections to the resurrection as well. So in Acts 23, there's this great scene where St. Paul is speaking before the Sanhedrin, and he talks about the gospel, but he presents it by introducing himself as a Pharisee and a son of Pharisees, and that he is being persecuted with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead, which is great because the Pharisees are going to love everything they just heard, and the Sadducees are going to hate everything they just heard. And so you get a clear sense that there is this question. As you say, the Pharisees don't believe Jesus rose from the dead. The Sadducees don't believe anybody can rise from the dead, ever, that there won't even be a resurrection at the last day. And so they're objecting to the resurrection in very different senses. And you see Paul very deftly sort of presenting the two sides this problem within themselves. And they end up having such a fight that the soldiers actually have to come in and break it up. So it's a fascinating kind of scene that shows us a little insight into especially a group like the Sadducees, who we hear so little about, because as you may well know, a fairly short time after all of this happens, you have the destruction of the temple in 70, and then you have the beginning of the diaspora, then you have the Bar Kokhba revolt in 132, and you just have this mass persecution, basically the extermination, extinction of the Sadducees, and a lot of the Jewish world of Jesus's day is gone within 100 years, and gone permanently. The priesthood, the Sadducees, all of this stuff is just kind of wiped out. And so as a result, we only have these little glimpses as to kind of how they understood the resurrection, how they understood what had happened, because their world was being upturned first by the rise of Christianity, but then by these other events as well.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that answer.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you very much. Thanks for the call and for the very kind words. The number here is 888-318-7884. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Ask Me Anything is our topic, and that means you can ask anything. We'll get more questions for Joe right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Joe Heschmeyer, our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Check out his podcast, Shameless Popery. Go to shamelessjoe.com. Go wherever you get your podcasts, or check out his YouTube channel, Shameless Popery, or check out shamelessjoe.com. All right, we're going to go now to Bob in Oxnard, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome, Bob. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Has anyone compiled a list of important or revealing early Christian writings that were not available until after the Reformation?
I don't know of one that is specific for only after the Reformation. So a little bit of historical background here. The Christians in the Middle Ages were too credulous, too willing to believe that anything that purported to be an ancient document was. And so they regularly fell for forgeries. And sometimes you'll have people who treat this like it was intentional and malicious. I don't think it was. I think they just were caught off guard by unscrupulous forgers. And so during the Renaissance, as people take a more critical eye towards everything, they rightly point out that many of these documents that had been assumed to be real were forgeries. And this includes, for instance, some letters that were ascribed to St. Ignatius of Antioch. They're early documents, but they're not actually by St. Ignatius. And they're not actually from, 107. And so at the time of the Reformation, one of the things going on is that even when documents exist, you have Protestants particularly who are very skeptical of any of the documents. And so on the Catholic side, there's maybe an overwillingness to believe that these early Christian writings are actually real, and some of them aren't. They're forgeries. On the Protestant side, there's a pretty radical skepticism about the early church. And so, famously, John Calvin and many Calvinists for centuries after deny that any of the letters of St. Ignatius of Antioch are real. And it's really not till you get Protestants like Lightfoot, who and Zan, who I think is Lutheran, in the 19th century, who really clear up a lot of the issue. And for that matter, on the Catholic side, John Henry Newman does a good job of helping to distinguish the real from the fake Ignatian epistles. They've come under renewed attack even since then. I had a debate with James White last month in which he called into question the reliability of the letters that are almost universally accepted as Ignatian, and claim that the scholarly consensus was turning against that. That's not really true. If you want good work just on Ignatius, Stephen Boyce, who is Anglican, has on his Facts podcast, has an episode called "Will the Real Ignatius Please Stand Up?" Evaluating the recensions with Ignatian scholar Jack Bull. That's going to get super into the weeds as to even like which forms of the letters and all that we know to be accurate. But if you really want to do a deep dive, I know I'm only answering on seven of the letters right now. But I say this to say a lot of the problem isn't that we didn't have letters, although there are obviously ancient documents that we didn't have in Latin or didn't have maybe at all. For instance, the Moratorian fragment is a good example of one that was a later find and has like one of the earliest biblical canons. So you have those kinds of things, but a lot of the questions were about authenticity and dating, and a lot of those questions were ones that just took a long time to kind of sort out. So even if we had the document before, we now know we can trust it or know that we can't trust it in a way we didn't at the time. A good book for just how this fits together in terms of these writings from the early Christians and what we believe as Catholics would be Jimmy Akin's book, The Fathers Know Best. And so if you want to stick around on the line, I'd be happy to make sure we can get a copy of that to you.
We most certainly can. Just hang on, Bob. We'll send it to you. Just, if you give us an address, we'll send it to you. I'm going to move just a little bit quick now because I want to get as many on as I can before we have to go. Derek is in Indiana. Derek, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, sir. I was wondering why Jesus never told the Pharisees or the Sadducees that he was born in Bethlehem, or that anyone that knew them, that understood the problem, could say that he was born in Bethlehem too.
Yeah, sure. I think the answer is probably that it isn't central to the claims that he's making. Now, it is true, there are important messianic prophecies that point to Bethlehem. But this doesn't appear to be the reason people are rejecting him. So I think as a result of that, he doesn't focus his energy on saying, no, I really am born in Bethlehem. I was just raised in Nazareth. It's not the reason that they're walking away or the reason they're saying no to him. That's my suspicion, because that appears to be just based on the mentions of it. We find people alluding to him being from Nazareth. We even find one of the apostles saying, can anything good come from Nazareth? But they're not making a philosophical objection that, hey, the messianic prophecy says Bethlehem, and so we should be looking for someone born there. It just doesn't seem like that objection is what people are raising against him.
Okay.
Right, thank you very much.
All right.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you very much. On we go. Let's go to, where am I going? Igor in Florida. Igor, are you there with us?
Yes.
All right.
Hi, Sai.
Hi, welcome.
My sympathies for the passing of your mother.
Thank you.
Certainly my prayers.
Thank you.
Beautiful words you shared in the opening of the broadcast.
Well, really thanks.
Inspiring a witness of our Catholic faith.
She was a really good mom.
I'm sure she was. Glad to hear that. Hi, Joe. Big fan.
Hi.
Watch your latest episode of the Shameless Popery podcast and mm-hmm. about Muslims and Christians worshiping the same God. I agree mm-hmm. with the premise that disagreeing about God doesn't necessarily mean we're talking about a different God. But mm-hmm. if that is true, what should then be our parameters? Meaning, what would one have to believe about their God to make it a different God? Like to see,
yeah.
for example, do they worship the same God as well? They think it's the one true God, right?
Oh, sorry, I missed that sentence. Which group are you asking about, or which?
The followers of Sikhism, for example. They claim to worship the one true God, the creator of the universe. So do they also worship the God that we do?
Okay, so yeah, let's unpack that. So we want to unpack it in two ways. Number one, and I would point to Romans 1, as I think you know, for this, that St. Paul can speak about the wicked pagans who he says know God but refuse to honor him. So that's pretty significant, because he doesn't say they don't know God because they don't have the Bible. They don't have, you know, the Old Testament. He doesn't say that at all. He claims that they do know him. And he says in Romans 1:19 that what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So someone who looks at the world, realizes that the world had to be created, realizes that whoever created it is eternally powerful, and realizes that whoever created it isn't a visible part of the world, they're talking about God. Now, they might then come up with a whole set of myths about what this God is like, and they might be man-made and false. They might even be demonic distortions to draw people away from true knowledge of God. But nevertheless, there is some core knowledge about the existence of God that's going on there. So, as St. Paul even says, although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. So you can be drawn away from what you already know or should know about God through falsehood and through sin. But we want to recognize that these are still claims being made about the one God. So I would say two things. Number one, the person who reasoning from reason alone comes to the fact that a God created the world is talking about the God of Abraham. They don't know. They've never heard of Abraham. They don't know anything about the Bible, etc. They may have a lot of wrong ideas about God, but they're still talking about the one God, because he's not just like a philosophical concept. He's real. He exists. Mm-hmm. Second, even like an atheist who denies God is talking about God. They're saying false things, evil things about God, but they're still talking about God. So if those two things are true, and I think those are almost unavoidably true, then it follows that a lot of what's going on in the world's religions may be people talking about God in a confused and ignorant way. And that lines up with the way the Bible talks about it. And for instance, in Acts 17, when St. Paul speaks to them in Athens, and he talks about them worshiping a God they don't know, and then calling them to full faith in Jesus Christ. Now, having said that, it's also possible for people to worship things that aren't God, like lesser spiritual entities, namely demons. And so St. Paul also talks about pagans doing that. So both of those things can be true. Some pagan worship is directed towards the true God. It's just distorted. We're not saying it's good, it's fine, whatever. We're just saying the one intended to be honored is God. Others are serving beings that they should know are clearly not the creator of the world, clearly not the creator of everything. So in terms of where that line is, there's a few things that we'd look at. Number one, what kind of claims are you making? And this is what's called the referent. So I give this example in the episode, but you know, if you look up in the sky and one person says it's a bird, one person says it's a plane, they're talking about the same thing. They disagree on all the properties. A bird and a plane aren't that much alike. But it's clear they're both directionally looking at the same object of reference, and so they're talking about the same thing. So if someone is talking about the creator of the world, they're talking about God. Even if they get every other thing wrong, they're still talking about God. Whereas someone who's talking about like tree spirits and idols and things like that, they're not talking about the creator of the world, and therefore they're not talking about God, whatever else they may say. So we can draw a principal distinction there at the level of reference. I don't know. Does that was, I had to do a lot more kind of background with that, because I assume not everybody listening.
I think it made a lot of sense. I appreciate the answer. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, good.
Thank you very much. Our next question seems to follow on, so I'm going to go on to it. Christopher in Arizona watching on YouTube. If you could be quick, Christopher, with your question, we'll be able to get you an answer. No? Oh, hang on, Christopher. That was me. I pushed the wrong button. Go ahead, Christopher.
That's okay.
Sorry.
Thank you, he literally warned ahead of the time he might do that.
I know. So, yeah, obviously it does relate to the previous question as well as the previous video. I suppose the first half of it, I will try to keep this brief. First half of it, I was actually questioning how much information was the church able to acquire before making a particular definition or explanation with regards to Islam, making any sort of official statement.
It depends which
well.
Period we're talking about. I'm going to answer that just in case we run out of time. You have obviously wildly different levels of exposure to Islam. So St. John of Damascus, for instance, he's writing in Damascus after Muslims have conquered it. And his father and his grandfather were Christians who worked in the government while it was run by the caliphate. And so he was deeply acquainted with Islam and seems to have spoken Arabic as well as Greek. Then you get like Western medieval Christians who at a certain age are so cut off that there's a lot of falsehoods being spread about, oh, there's like these three gods in Islam. And you'll occasionally see Christian writers in the West, not really the saints, interestingly, who have like very obviously confused understandings about Muslims and about Islam. But when you talk about the church as such, the church documents on Islam, whether we're talking about like in the 11th century or more recently like Vatican II, they seem to have a pretty decent understanding of at least the core. You know, this is a take on the Christian story, but making radically different claims about God that I think is well informed.
Okay.
The issue too, that was kind of fun, but the analogy that you had also mentioned as well, because while I could see, and I suppose too, it's because of more information that has come out on the internet, especially within the past several years. It seems from especially my perspective, I'm not trying to go against church teaching or anything, but from what I have noticed, it seems like online it makes more sense for Christians and Jews to basically argue whether or not Clark Kent is Superman, but it seems like Muslims are basically saying it's Lex Luthor.
Oh,
yeah.
So I think that's kind of why, yeah, there's, yeah. Apologies.
Unfortunately, I don't have time to reply to that, but you can have evil things ascribed to God. I would argue even some Christian authors do this, but that doesn't mean that they're not talking about God. It means they're saying wicked things about God.
I wonder if you were thinking about John Calvin.
I was, but I didn't want to like throw that bomb against Calvinists and then just like,
oh yeah,
on.
that's
but
kind of unfair. I mean, apologize for that.
I think any non-Calvinist would probably recognize, yeah, he says some things that sound wicked about God. That doesn't mean he's not talking about God. It means he's speaking ill of him.
Christopher, thanks so much. That brings us to the end. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for two fantastic hours.
My pleasure.
All right, let me know if you get a visitor from the Conclave. If anybody shows up at your house, I'd like to know.
I will make a
Shoot
YouTube
a
video
text.
About it only after the fact.
All right.
Sworn to secrecy.
See you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.